Find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sönke Löw. Some time ago, I watched a Netflix show called Atypical. Atypical is a show which tells the story of a kid or a boy with autism or on the autism disorder spectrum and kind of shows where his difficulties are and where he's really good at, and also shows in a really lovely way how he navigates his day-to-day life, how he's interested in things, and how he also struggles with challenges that are quite normal for neurotypical people. And today we are going to talk about exactly this topic. Well, we're not going to talk about the show, but we're going to talk about autism. And for this, we have invited Muhib Teshan. I got a nod for the name. Muhib has written a paper on autism, and today we will focus on not the, well, the maybe typical way of how autism is perceived as a deficit, but more about how far it can also be a chance for all of us. So welcome to our show today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And as usual, we like to start with our welcome game, where I start a sentence and I want you to spontaneously continue them. But I think like the joke runs out the more episodes we make. Maybe like the answers are not that spontaneous anymore, but we're going to play the game anyway. And the first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
Yeah, it's kind of funny and also a bit boring. Maybe I wanted to be a computer programmer, as far as I can remember. Maybe before that it was something else, but I don't know what it was. So it was computer programming, and I did become one eventually. So
that's nice. The second question is, if I was an emoji, I would be.
So I guess maybe this upside down smiling face. I like it because it's kind of happy, but also, you know, in a cheeky way, it's a bit different. So I like that one.
Didn't you also like that
one? No, it was Alina.
I see. Yeah.
But also one of our guests said it, and I can't remember who it was.
It's a popular one. Then.
Yeah, it is. It is, actually. Cool. But I also like it.
Yeah, I think like it's generally maybe niche, but like in Coxy circuits, it's like like very... Our spirit emoji somehow.
Cool.
The third sentence is, my favorite thing to do on a day off is...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like walking, long walks, or riding my bike to somewhere nice, maybe a beer garden, and sit down and have a beer and just read.
That sounds good. So you're looking forward to warmer and less rainy weather?
Yeah, definitely.
Right now, I'm most fascinated by...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always fascinated by multiple things. I think right now I can say I'm into this field of computational psychiatry, learning about all these computational models of psychiatric disorders and so on. So nowadays, I am more and more into that, I would say.
I think we're going to talk about that, or might end up talking about that as well, because it's also related to autism, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite related.
Yeah.
And the final question is, I know it's time to call it a day when...
I don't always know, but I guess when I realize that I get distracted more than usual, then it's time to call it off.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Yeah. You are currently doing your master's in cognitive science at the University of Osnabrück. Can you maybe say or tell us how you ended up here? Did you do the bachelor's here? Did you do a different bachelor? How was your scientific journey so far?
Yeah, I didn't do my bachelor's here. So I mentioned that I became a computer programmer. I was born in Turkey, Istanbul. And I studied there. I did a bachelor's in computer science. And then I actually worked as a software developer for quite a long time before switching to cognitive science.
And how did you find cognitive science? Was it by coincidence, or did you start actively looking for, well, something to learn more or?
Yeah, it was actually back then, which was a long time ago, when I was about to graduate from computer science. I think I came across cognitive science online somewhere and saw that, you know, it studies the mind and it's interdisciplinary, bringing together, you know, AI, linguistics, philosophy, psychology, and so on. And that fascinated me because I love all of those topics individually, and a discipline that brings them all together, it's like heaven. So I actually wanted to immediately do a master's degree in cognitive science. But back then, mostly due to financial reasons, let's say, I said, okay, I'm going to work for a few years as a software developer and then go back. And those few years became more and more. And then I moved to Germany, also found a job as a software developer in Berlin. And I worked here a little bit. And I would say during the pandemic, I said, okay, I will go on Coursera and look at some courses. And there was an introduction to cognitive science course. And then I remember how much I love this. So I said, okay, yeah, I'll join a master's program here. And yeah, now I want to go into that direction.
It's really amazing how you came back to it after quite some time in working, because I feel like often when people start working, they kind of forget what they usually or initially wanted to do and just stick with the area they've been working in.
Yeah, yeah. I also kind of forgot in those years. Not entirely. I was always reading some books related to it or some articles online and so on. So my love never really died out. But yeah, as a career path, I kind of forgot. That's what happens. Like you work, if you're a software developer, I don't know, you get a relatively good salary and so on. So you tend to... Also, I liked working as a software developer, mostly because of the people. I think a lot of great people are in software development, so it has a good environment. But yeah, it's always nice to remember what you love and what you actually wanted to do. So it was kind of like finding a friend that you haven't seen for such a long time and then getting back together. So that was nice.
That sounds really good, yeah. And, well, now we're not talking about software development in this episode. We're going to talk about autism.
Yeah.
Can you maybe give us a short overview of what autism is, what symptoms are, and just what people should know when they've never heard about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, autism, it's nowadays called autism spectrum disorder. Spectrum means basically it is a condition where a vast variety of different cognitive abilities and disabilities come together in a unique way, so it can present itself very differently in each individual. So some people think that spectrum means it's like goes from less autism to more autism. That's not how it works, but it's more like we can think of it like a color palette or this light spectrum. I don't know, you have red, green, blue, they come in, you know, different combinations. And yeah, that's how autism spectrum works. Like that's what spectrum means in that sense. And it's a neurodevelopmental condition, which means it is about the way your brain works, about the way your brain develops from childhood. As far as we know, you are born autistic. It's not something you catch later on in life. And it's... I think probably our listeners already know this, but it's not caused by vaccines. That's like a big misconception. It has been debunked over and over again. It is mostly genetic and it's there from birth or at least very, very early childhood. And yeah, the symptoms. It is characterized by two sets of symptoms, let's say. The first one is social reciprocal communication, so deficits in social reciprocal communication. We will talk a bit about the deficit side maybe, but let's first go the default way. So the first set of symptoms is about socializing. The second one is restricted repetitive movements, behaviors, and interests, something very long and in a way vague. Mm-hmm. That's why always we have to go through examples to understand what it is, because it is very heterogeneous. As I said, it presents itself very differently in each individual. That's why we have such broad definitions. Also for the social reciprocal part, it is also a bit vague, but usually how it presents is, for example, not being able to make eye contact when speaking, or not liking it, like making less eye contact than usual, or maybe too much, or facial expressions, not having enough facial expressions, or having also problems understanding other people's facial expressions, body language, idioms, sarcasm, metaphors, jokes, etc. There can be problems understanding those. So that kind of stuff, everything about social interactions, like knowing when to initiate a conversation, knowing when to stop speaking, and so on. These are all the different ways that can be seen in autistic people. And when talking about the symptoms, we have to say that each of these symptoms can be seen in lots of people. It doesn't mean you're autistic. It's just both sets of symptoms have to exist, and have to exist from a very early age, because some of them are normal, they're found in typical people. Some of them can be a result of something else, some other condition. But yeah, so there is the social aspect, social interaction aspect. And the second one is this restricted repetitive movements, etc. We can sort of divide it into subsets. First one is repetitive movements. These are usually, they are also called stimming, which is short for self-stimulatory behavior. So it's usually done for emotional regulation. It can be repetitive movements, like some common ones are flapping your hands when you're happy, or jumping and turning around, or rocking back and forth when you're distressed, or at any time, actually. So those kind of stereotyped, as they call stereotyped repetitive movements, it is quite common. It can also present as some like rigidity in behavior, always wanting to follow the exact same schedule, wanting things to be the same. If you're walking from home to school, maybe you always go through the same way, and if a road is blocked, you can get very distressed. So there is this rigid behavior component. There's the restricted interests, which is kind of fun compared to the others, maybe, because it is about a limited set of interests, usually that you can have maybe a couple of interests that you are intensely interested in, and you just like talking about it, learning about it, and so on. So these special interests, as it's also called, they can be anything, but again, some stereotypical ones are dinosaurs, anime, Lego, sci-fi, and so on. So having an intense interest in those, and these interests usually, they are not short-lived, like you are interested in them for years, maybe a lifetime. Some people build careers on top of those. You can be interested in dinosaurs and grow up to be a paleontologist or something, you know. So there is some positive side to it as well. And the last, I would say, is the sensory sensitivities. So autistic people usually have some sort of sensory sensitivity, like oversensitivity to sound or lights, certain smells, and so on. They may be very distressed by those, or they may be seeking certain sounds or certain touch, like some texture, and so on. So that's also very common. So yeah, these are basically the symptoms. There are also co-occurrences that are pretty common in autism. One is intellectual disorder. So yeah, this development of, you know, intelligence, cognitive capabilities, basically like having low IQ, for example. This can accompany autism, and it is quite common, but not in the majority of the cases. I don't know the exact number, but it would be something around, I don't know, 40% maybe. But it is separate than autism. They occur together very commonly, but it is something, let's say, additional. Mm. Also, language impairment, not being able to acquire language in time, maybe having only a few words or phrases that they use. So it can be severe language impairment, or it can be mild, like some syntactic difficulties and so on. So that's also quite common.
Something I feel like is quite a lot on social media at the moment is late diagnosed women with autism disorder. Mm-hmm. So I also feel like when I grew up, most things I've heard about autism was always concerning men or boys. Do you know any reasons for that, or why is that the case?
Yeah, there are probably multiple reasons, but that is definitely the case. Like before, it was thought to be predominantly in boys. But now we know it is at least like one third, I think. But there are many projections that say that's actually there's no difference. Like it can be seen in girls as well as boys. Some reasons for that difference is it has been studied quite a lot in boys, but not in girls. Some of those symptoms can present differently. Or, for example, those special interests. Maybe girls were more accepted, or maybe people weren't worried when they are interested in something. Or girls were always taught from a very young age to socialize more than boys. So maybe they learn to mask it from an early age, so they may miss some symptoms. But now we know more about it, how it presents in girls. So the gap is getting smaller and smaller.
What is the typical, or like other typical differences? Or, because I've heard that especially females tend to learn or to mask social behavior more efficiently than boys, for example. Mm-hmm. Learn to kind of analyze the proper amount of looking in another person's eye, or of reacting to what is said properly. And I was right now just wondering if there's any reason why girls are performing better in that learning compared to boys.
That is definitely the case, what you described, but the reasons we are not so sure, I would say. Like, we are not sure if it's something biological related to sex differences, or is it just social? Is it the way that girls are conditioned to behave, so to speak? Maybe they are expected more to be social, so they have to learn it more from a young age. Or maybe there is something more fundamental, we don't know. But there is definitely a slight difference in that case. Girls seem to be able to adapt more to social norms better than boys in that sense. But yeah, we don't know exactly why.
We have heard that like the symptoms, and that's like the usual case display like in the behavior, but do we also know if there is a difference in like the neural anatomy of the people? Can we like pinpoint, or is that also like on a spectrum and that's from person to person different?
There are many different theories, but none of them have been confirmed. It seems to affect, I don't know, basically the whole brain. There are different theories about the cortex, how, for example, some theories say it is about the white matter connection between different regions in the cortex, so about this interconnectedness of the different areas like visual area, auditory area, and so on. But that's not confirmed either, as far as I know. Some people say it's about mirror neurons. That doesn't really seem to be the case, and we don't know much about mirror neurons in humans, actually.
Can you just quickly say what mirror neurons are for a person who has never heard of neurobiology?
Yeah, so mirror neurons are these type of neurons in the motor cortex, I think. So they fire when you are making a certain movement, and also they fire when you observe someone making the same movement. So there are some studies from other primates, but in humans we don't have enough studies. But there are a lot of ideas about what mirror neurons do. Some people say it's required for empathy and so on. Sounds reasonable, but we don't have enough evidence for that as far as I know.
And when we think about mirror neurons in autism, the assumption would be that they have less or less connected mirror neurons, or what's the connection?
Yeah, something wrong with mirror neurons, okay. They would say. I think they're called like the broken mirror hypothesis or something. Yeah. But as far as I know, it's not confirmed, not something taken too seriously, at least nowadays.
And there's no general structure that is different in people with autism spectrum disorder compared to neurotypical?
At least not something that everyone agrees on. There are a lot of different studies on basically every area of the brain, and there are always studies that found differences in most of those areas. But yeah, so far there is not a region in the brain that you can pinpoint and say, oh, this is autism.
Yeah, so maybe it's also since how autism shows in the behavior, well, might also just display in the brain structure. So when each autistic person or each person on the autism spectrum is different compared to another person, it makes sense that also their brain structures are different.
Yeah, exactly. For example, with sensory sensitivities, like some people are sensitive to sound, some to lights, then you would expect them to have different differences in the brain, I don't know, in the auditory processing or visual processing and so on. So yeah, it's since it's very heterogeneous, meaning it presents very differently in different people, yeah, it would be also very hard to pinpoint in the brain where exactly that happens, I think.
Yeah. And we've just talked about, or I've mentioned the term neurotypical. I know what it means. I don't know if everyone else has heard about the term when they didn't really think about, well, the brain before, or that much about the brain. So can you maybe explain what neurotypical is and how far neurotypical differs from not neurotypical people?
Yeah, that's a good question. So neurotypical is basically typically developing children, or those children who grow up to be adults. So someone who has developed typically. So it is usually used, yeah, in contrast to neurodivergences, which are the conditions or disorders that diverge from the norm, diverge from the typical. So we define a normal brain structure or behavior, and then if you are normal in that sense, you are neurotypical. If not, you are neurodivergent. Historically, this has a lot to do with autism, the history of autism, and the idea of neurodiversity. So if you are autistic, you are not neurotypical. You are neurodivergent. There are also some other conditions, disorders, for example, ADHD, dyslexia, that are also neurodivergencies. So if you have one of those conditions, you are neurodivergent. And this ties nicely into the idea of neurodiversity, which says the diversity of different types of brains, let's say, of course, people with different types of brains coming together. So the idea of neurodiversity was put forward mostly by autistic people, autism advocates, claiming that autism is not just a disorder, or not a disorder per se, that is defined only by deficits, but it is something that is a natural variation of the human brain. So it's not a disorder or something like that should be destroyed or whatever, but it is something that is natural, that happens naturally in humans, and it has its advantages as well as disadvantages. So it is sort of like a cognitive trade-off between different abilities. And in that sense, like a famous phrase is different, not less. Mm-hmm. So it's autistic people are just different in their type of perceiving the world and interacting with it, not less than other people or less than neurotypicals, let's say. So yeah, it is a relatively newish idea, although you can find its roots back in, for example, Temple Grandin, who is a kind of famous autistic woman who was diagnosed in the 60s. She became an animal behaviorist and so on, and she made a lot of public speeches about autism. For the first time, a lot of people saw an autistic person talking about this subject. And she was stressing this point quite a lot. She still does this like different, not less perspective. And then with the rise of the internet, actually, a lot of autistic people found each other online and they started advocating for their own rights. So this neurodiversity movement became a social movement, basically, that has also ties with other disability rights movements. And the idea is that, yeah, you can have problems in society, but it is because your needs are not accommodated by the society. If we design the world not just for neurotypicals, but also for neurodivergent people, that will make their lives easier. That's what we do with other disabilities, right? For blind people, deaf people, or like if you have to use a wheelchair, nowadays it's much easier compared to the past, thankfully. So we can also design our society in a way to accommodate the needs of neurodivergent people. So that's the main idea.
Maybe at this point we could go a bit into, well, the question, you've already answered it, but go a bit more into the whole topic of viewing autism as something that's beneficial in some areas, while other areas are more challenging for individuals. So where are typical areas where, let's start off with problems autistic people have and then go into things we as a society can also benefit from them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. For example, in education or in professional life also, like in job interviews, people are expected to make a lot of eye contact regardless of the job usually. Even if you're not interacting directly with people, you are still expected to perform in a certain way in job interviews. And that puts autistic people into an unfair disadvantage. So that should be changed, can be changed. I know as a software developer, actually a lot of software companies were already a bit more tolerant about these issues compared to most other professions. Because, you know, software engineers are expected to be a bit, I don't know, awkward or whatever.
So that fits into the cliche.
Yeah, yeah. But nowadays also big companies, they are explicitly also talking about neurodiversity and how to make it better. So of course, it's not just the job interview, also how you interact with your colleagues, what you are expected, what kind of social performance you are expected. Also in schools, like children, I don't know, if they are not making eye contact, doesn't mean they are not interested or suspicious or hiding something. There is also a big problem with, for example, police force. Like if an autistic person is somehow a suspect, not making eye contact, not being able to, you know, maybe speak much, that can look extra suspicious, and that has led to some bad cases in the US, I think. So there are lots of different areas of life where autistic people are put to a disadvantage. And yeah, we can overcome these challenges, I think, in education, in professional life, also in social life in general. Yeah.
I think I read that some supermarkets in Germany started to have quiet hours mm-hmm. for people who are sensitive to sound and light. I think it also started with this neurodivergent movement that they were like, well, people with special needs or high sensitivity to sounds and all kinds of stimuli need that to, well, be supported easily. And I actually like that idea as well a lot, because also to me, supermarkets are super stressful because there's just so much sound, advertisement, music, yeah. lights. There's so many stimuli. And I can just imagine how hard it must be for a person who's even more sensitive than I am.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's great that you reminded me, because I was going to talk about it, but I forgot. The supermarkets, shopping malls, etc., like you said, they can be a sensory hell for autistic people because of all the bright lights, loud noises, lots of different smells all together, and so on. But yeah, we can do something like these quiet supermarkets or whatever. But it would be a good experience for everyone, I think. Because, they do that because they want you to rush and be, you know, alert and just do some quick shopping and then get on with your life. But if it's more quiet, more calm, not so, you're not going to get so panicked and anxious. And I think it will be good for everyone. But yeah, that's a really good example of applying neurodiversity to social life.
Over the last years, like the diversity movement in all aspects, like probably is on the rise, and that's always something good. And especially, like, I think, like, with people on the autistic spectrum, they, as you said, like, they have special interests usually, and they get really deep into it. So maybe they are outperforming other people who don't are that interested in it, or are there other, like, big advantages or tasks where autistic people have a great advantage?
Definitely special interests can be a case. That doesn't mean that you are necessarily gifted or you will be interested in something that can earn money, but yeah, sometimes it is, and yeah, it is a good, great advantage actually if you can just spend hours and hours and days over something that other people don't spend so much intense time on. So yeah, it does bring an advantage in certain cases. Especially fields like science or like the STEM fields, or where you need to practice something a lot or learn a lot about something. Yeah, it can be an advantage. There is also of this processing style in autism. We can talk a bit about different theories of autism, and we can come back to that. But basically, autistic people are much more detail-oriented in their cognitive processing style, let's say. So they tend to focus on details more than neurotypical people. And this can also bring some advantages in certain jobs. Where you need to focus on the details, that can be an advantage.
And also, I think, at least I've heard that autistic people usually are not that emotion-led when they come to decisions. So, like, most human beings make decision based on some emotional component. And I think, but I can be really mistaken here, that I've read that people who are on the autism spectrum tend to make especially moral decisions more focused on the outcome, but not on the actual reasoning people made or, well, acted a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are different studies based on morality, rational decision making, and so on. So, for example, because of this detail-oriented style, they tend to focus on, like, the local context and not take the global context that much
into
it.
or turn that into more practical terms? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this can show itself as something like there are some cognitive biases that are sort of the ways that our minds work that are not always beneficial. Maybe overall in the big picture it can be beneficial, but sometimes we fall into certain traps in our thinking, let's say. And it is used a lot, for example, in marketing, because they want us to buy products, so they design their marketing commercials, or even like the supermarkets where they put stuff. So this is about decision making. And there are studies that show that autistic people tend to make more rational choices when it comes to this sort of consumer behavior, because they tend less to fall into these marketing traps. For example, they can trick you into buying one product over the other with some certain tricks. Like if they put a third product that is related to one of those, then people tend to choose whatever they like, the targeted product, for example.
Interesting.
Yeah. But autistic people tend to fall into this less than usual. So there is some, I guess, strength there. So to not fall for marketing tricks as usual. But also, yeah, you mentioned moral decision making. There seem to be some differences, but there are also, I think, conflicting studies. But it's usually like they tend to focus on the outcomes of your behavior rather than your intentions. But they also tend not to, they also tend to be more forgiving, I would say. And when they are engaging in moral behavior, what usually happens with neurotypical people, this was from one study about morality, if you are going to choose between a good choice, like a morally good choice, like helping someone, or like donating money to a charity or whatever, or a selfish cause, maybe you will earn money by doing or supporting something bad. So the good choice and the bad choice, neurotypical people tend to choose the good one in public, but if nobody knows what they're gonna choose, then they tend to, maybe I will choose the selfish one. In autistic people in that study, it was shown that first, they tend to choose the good option more often, and also they don't change their behavior so much based on other people sees it or not. So even in private, they tend to choose the good option. What's interesting is in the first version of the study, the authors said, they looked at this data and they said, okay, so autistic people are overly concerned about their moral choices.
But they're not, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it's a decision, I guess, about moral philosophy, probably, more than psychology. Like, okay, can we say, yeah, you should do the bad thing if you're in private? I don't think we can say that, you know. But since it was the autistic group who didn't do that, who chose the good thing in private, that behavior was sort of pathologized and said, ah, this is wrong. You should be more selfish. So this is related to this deficit-based view. Like autism is always defined in terms of deficits. So in a sense, maybe researchers sometimes tend to think, okay, whatever the autistic group does is wrong, or like it is always this normative descriptions, mm-hmm. like whatever the typical group does is the one that is normal, and the other thing, yeah, it's wrong. So I think this comes from that. So we should be more careful about this deficit-based view. So there can be some advantages or some good things, also some disadvantages and some bad things. So.
At the beginning of the interview, you said that you are currently fascinated by computational psychiatry. And I mean, you already hinted before the interview started that there's also like a strong connection to autism. Can you maybe shine a light on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So computational psychiatry is basically a relatively new sub-discipline that came from computational neuroscience, of course, that applies computational models of cognition to psychiatric disorders. And of course, as autism is defined as a psychiatric disorder, it is also a field of study. So computational psychiatry uses models like reinforcement learning models, Bayesian models, and so on, to explain the underlying mechanisms behind, for example, addiction or depression, anxiety, OCD, or autism. So I find those fascinating because those models usually approach autism from a completely different perspective compared to main theories of autism. We actually didn't talk much about different theories of autism, but there is, for example, in the mainstream, the big idea about autism is that autistic people lack theory of mind, which is the ability to understand that other people have beliefs different than your own, and being able to infer what they believe or think or feel. So it's also called cognitive empathy or mentalizing, mind reading, and so on. And the theory was that autistic people lack this cognitive ability. But the research is mixed, let's say. There are some tasks that autistic people tend to fail more than neurotypical people. But why that is the case is not really well known, I would say. And there are different explanations of them. So this idea of lack of theory of mind abilities, it's still, I think, the most prominent one. But yeah, there are also other explanations. And one of them, for example, is about this detail-oriented processing style. And the theories from computational psychiatry, they talk about autism from the perspective of sensory processing. So it's mostly about, well, it will be a bit technical maybe for the common listener, but they relate to, for example, there's the Bayesian brain hypothesis or predictive coding. So these theories in general, not for autism, but these theories basically say that the brain always makes some predictions about the world. So that you can be ready for whatever is coming. And also it's more efficient in terms of processing. So you build a model of the world based on your experience. And you always try to predict what is going to happen based on this model. If your predictions fail, then you update your model. And autism in computational psychiatry is usually explained in terms of, for example, overly precise prediction errors. So you rely more on the actual sensory stimuli rather than your model of the world. It can be because maybe your models aren't strong enough, or maybe the sensory stimuli is just too strong. But what happens is you don't just... Normally, we sort of hallucinate the world we live in, and it is controlled by this sensory stimuli. Yeah, it's called controlled hallucination. So that is how our brains work, according to these theories. That is how we perceive reality. We don't perceive it directly, but based on these models, we sort of create a simulation of the world, and we perceive that. But in autism, this model, this simulation, let's say, is less confident. So you perceive the sensory stimuli more directly, more detailed. There is a really good article with a really good name, I would say, by Pelicano and Burr from 2012, I think, titled When the World Becomes Too Real. That is about the computational explanation of autism in terms of the Bayesian brain hypothesis. So yeah, basically they say autism can be explained in terms of a model that is not strong enough or overly strong sensory input. So this can explain basically all aspects of autism. For example, the social life, it is very dynamic. There are a lot of cues, like everyone's faces change a lot. The way the places they look, their body language changes a lot, actually. But normally what we do is we get rid of irrelevant details and build a big picture out of it to understand the social context. But if you are too focused on the details or you perceive the details very strongly, then it's really hard to process all of them in time and understand the social context. Or in that case, maybe you would be more likely to focus on a restricted set of interests that you're familiar with that are easier to predict. Especially like, I don't know, math, science, certain areas may be more attractive for autistic people, which is the case. So that also makes sense from this perspective. Yeah, also it explains the sensory oversensitivities quite well. So I think that's a new area and there's a lot of research being done. There is not any definitive answer yet also from that field. But I think it is exciting and promising.
Are the same models applied for autistic people as to neurotypical people, or are there different models for autistic people?
Yeah, so the model, let's say, is the same, mm-hmm. but the parameters of the model would change. So there is a fundamental way that we perceive the world, but then the idea would be maybe, yeah, in, I don't know how much detail I should go in, but in Bayesian models, you have the priors, which represent your expectations. You have the likelihood, which represent the sensory data. And then you perceive the world as a combination of those. And that's the basic model. And for autistic people, the likelihood, which is a probability distribution, can be too strong. Mm-hmm. Or the priors can be too narrow, too uniformly distributed. So yeah, the basic models are the same, but usually the parameters or some details of the models can be different.
Now we have heard a lot about the scientific perspective of it or on it, and but there's also like the personal aspect. Like some people may be discovering that they self might be on the autistic spectrum, or they have like a child and they think it could be on the autistic spectrum. Is there anything like these people should really know or take away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is actually a really good point, especially with, you know, social media, TikTok, YouTube, Twitter, and so on. There are a lot of autistic people talking about their own experiences, and there are a lot of people who relate to those experiences. So first of all, there is the issue of diagnosis. Some people say, okay, I like all of those things that autistic people talk about, they are me, they like relate a lot, I relate a lot to them, and they may want to pursue a diagnosis. It is a bit harder to get diagnosed as an adult, but it is possible. But then again, for example, I think in Germany, in most places, you have to wait for 2-3 years on the wait list. So there are some difficulties depending on the country. In some places it's easier, but mostly it's difficult. But still, if you think you may be autistic, I would say don't diagnose yourself over 2 TikToks that you have seen. But if you're really relating a lot and it seems to explain something about you that you have never really realized before, and it makes sense, and it can be good for you, then it is to understand yourself, it can be good for you. But still, I would be a bit cautious and try to pursue a professional diagnosis. But in most cases, autistic communities online, let's say, they are welcoming people who self-diagnosed because of these difficulties around getting an official diagnosis. So it is, I think, good to be really informed about it. And if you relate to it and it explains a lot, it can be a journey of self-discovery for some people. If it's good for your mental health, sure, learn more about it. Go and research it. Also from scientific sources, not just from TikTokers. Not that, I mean, that is also useful information for a lot of people, but yeah, we should be a bit cautious. But yeah, a lot of people actually also find out that they're autistic when they have children who get diagnosed with autism. And then they start to learn about autism, and then they say, wait a minute.
That's me.
I have all of those. Yeah, that's me. So that is also quite common because the autism diagnosis have changed quite a lot over the years. It was much harder. Like a lot of people wouldn't be diagnosed if they are born in the 70s or 80s, but nowadays they can get a diagnosis because autism definition has changed. It has broadened quite a lot. So yeah, it can be useful for people to understand themselves. I would say go and look for resources from as diverse sources as possible. There are some really good books that I can recommend, maybe. There is one from a journalist, Steve Silberman, called Neurotribes. It tells the story of autism from a historical perspective, and it does a really, really good job. So I would recommend Neurotribes. There is the book by Temple Grandin, The Autistic Brain. Usually that's where people start with. So I could recommend those. If you are more interested in, I don't know, computational theories, yeah, you can find articles about that as well. But I think if you think you're autistic or if your child has been diagnosed, I think the first rule is don't panic. It is not the end of the world. It is not necessarily a bad thing. It depends on the specific problems that you have or your child has. So it is important to know when there is a problem and try to fix that specific problem. Like, is it about speech, language? You can go to a speech therapist. Is it about social anxiety, or you can pursue, you know, regular like therapies or whatever about social anxiety? Or there are lots of different special education schools, for example, depending on the child's individual needs. Mm-hmm. So you cannot just say, oh, autistic, therefore bad, therefore it's doomed. No. It can have advantages, and find out that what you like or what your child likes, and be positive about it, be encouraging, and about the specific problems. Yeah, think of them individually, like about the specific problems. There is no magic cure of autism, and there doesn't have to be. So that would be my advice, I guess.
Yeah. I think we're going to link the books you just mentioned in the show notes in the end.
And with that, we always like to have or get the context to cognitive science of the topic we talked about. And in this case, like you already mentioned, a lot of different topics or a lot of different areas that are relevant to cognitive science. Do you maybe want to quickly go through what you think was like very relevant for your personal experience that played into researching this field?
Yeah, since autism is very broad and it is about the way our brains work, is very deeply connected with cognitive science. And there are lots of different areas from perception, as we talked about, language, social cognition. Those are all topics that are part of cognitive science, I would say. So you can approach it from a psychology perspective. You can build computational models of it and so on. So I think it is a very broad area. And cognitive science is also a very broad area. And I think autism, to understand autism, we need interdisciplinary perspectives, like how does language and social cognition interact, or, you know, what is a deficit, what is a disorder, and so on. There is some philosophical side to it. So I think to understand autism, we need multidisciplinary perspectives. And yeah, I think cognitive science can definitely help with that.
Yeah. And well, we have touched a lot of different topics in the last hour. When a person has listened to this episode, what should they definitely remember about autism and everything connected to it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a list of deficits. It can have its advantages. So autistic people are not less than neurotypical people. They are different.
Yeah. I think with that being said, thank you so much for coming here, talking to us, explaining this whole field to us, and, well, I think showing us quite nice perspective on autism spectrum disorders.
Thank you.
When you enjoy listening to us, the best way to support us is by following us on your chosen podcast app. This could either be Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or the website of a cognitive science student journal. Another good way to support us is by following our Instagram account, which is called kaleidoscience_pod. On our Instagram account, you will also get regular information on the next episode. Thanks a lot for supporting us. This was Kaleidoscience, hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sönke Löw, produced by Alina Ohnesorge, Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through conversations on cognitive science.